Let's go on to the next witness. Mr. Frederick.
Good morning.
Good morning, Mr. Chairman.
Oh, excuse me. Here he is. Sorry, Carl.
All right.
You got a coffee here, Mr. Chairman.
I'll tell you, I'll make you a deal.
We're friends. We can sit here together.
I'm sorry, Mr. Chairman. I really was out searching for coffee.
We know you sent out a search.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Senator Larry Hill, District 21. I think the bill's been described fairly well for what it does. Let me just summarize rather than repeat testimony. One, this is a pro-family bill. This is a bill that removes the possibility that a woman who is working in the workforce will have to make the decision between having a healthy pregnancy or having a job. That's what it comes down to. Currently, there's nothing to prevent a woman from being fired or being forced to take time off because of threat of miscarriage. There's nothing to protect that woman's job. Now, she may have a negotiated contract, but frankly, not many women do, that protect her and the baby. What this says is that women are subject to particular circumstances. Men aren't. Pregnancy and pregnancy-related disabilities. Men aren't confronted with that. None of us are. So we don't have to face the possibility of job loss or making the choice to remain on the job with possible damage to the baby or yourself. But a woman does. And that's why the Supreme Court has said it's okay for states to provide these kinds of protections. It's not special treatment. Instead, it removes a barrier that a woman may encounter in the workplace to keeping a job because she encounters pregnancy and men don't. And she shouldn't be fired because she has complications or she has to get away from a toxic substance on the job during her pregnancy, as long as it's medically necessary. The bill provides protections provided by other states. It's based upon medical necessity. It's based upon the concept that a woman should be able to protect herself and her pregnancy from damage in the workplace. We believe it's reasonable to help women make that decision and protect them if they make that decision. We believe that the terms of the bill are reasonable for the employer. We don't believe that an employer should fire a woman simply because the woman chooses not to expose herself and her fetus, her baby, to a damaging condition in the workplace. That's pure and simple what the bill does. I'd be glad to answer questions.
Questions of Senator Hill? Thank you.
Thank you.
Now we'll try Mr. Frederick.
My name is Carl Frederick. I'm director of legislation for Associated Oregon Industries. I would like to speak in opposition to Senate Bill 518. As you've heard, under the bill, it would be an unfair practice for an employer to refuse to allow a pregnant female employee to transfer to a less strenuous or hazardous job for the duration of the pregnancy, or refuse to allow her to take a leave of absence with a right to return to a former equivalent job. This bill, in our opinion, overlaps existing laws which adequately protect the rights of pregnant female employees, and we feel will burden Oregon employers by forcing short-term transfers virtually at the request of the employee. The bill would and could, in many instances, impose substantial burdens on Oregon businesses by forcing employers to abandon work assignments which are based on efficient use of personnel. Under the proposal, pregnant employees would have virtually a unilateral right to demand a different job. The bill provides that if the employee's personal physician recommends transfer, then that opinion shall be determinative. Under such a bill, an employee might be able to obtain a note from her physician based upon desire rather than medical necessity. Under such conditions, control of the workforce, a traditional management right, will be substantially diluted. Decisions by management regarding personnel assignments are based upon many factors, including training required, skill and ability of the employees, familiarity with the product or process, availability to work designated hours, speed, accuracy, and quality work, and interpersonal skills. An employer's efforts to find a less strenuous job or less hazardous work for a pregnant employee will inevitably involve rearranging other personnel assignments. If a pregnant employee is not trained or does not possess the skill or knowledge needed on the less strenuous or less hazardous work, this could cause a disruptive and inefficient personnel situation. Further, I think that other employees may be moved to jobs where they are inefficient. Finally, when the pregnant employee eventually leaves at childbirth, another round of personnel changes will be needed to staff the jobs. For these reasons, Senate Bill 518 should not be enacted, in our opinion.
Questions of Mr. Frederick? Thank you very much. Colleen Haas.
Chairman
Chipper.
Good morning. Members of the committee. Colleen Haas, Director of Local Government Personnel Institute. Current law requires that pregnancy disability be treated in the same way an employer treats any other disability for off-the-job injury, illness. SB 518 provides for special treatment for disability due to pregnancy. Our concerns in opposition to Senate Bill 518 include the fact that it affects employers of all sizes, whether or not they have sufficient workforce to absorb the employee, the work of the employee due to the pregnancy disability. The leave may extend for a few days to many months. There's no consideration of an employer's ability to find trained temporary replacements for the employee. Most sick leave policies of local governments currently provide for a period of temporary disability, whatever the cause. This would expand, in some cases, overrule, in other cases, those current policies in place. The bill does not distinguish in any way between full-time, part-time, regular, probationary, or seasonal employees. It provides that all employees, no matter what their status, will have that right to return or to transfer to another job. It's already been explained that that employee may or may not be qualified. Additionally, the bill provides that a physician's recommendation on transfer to an appropriate position due to pregnancy. However, there is no such provision regarding a leave of absence. The bill provides that the employee may choose to take a leave of absence. The employee may choose to take a leave of absence even though there may be alternative work available to her that the physician may have approved of. There's no stipulation that the employee is required to transfer. They may take a leave. There's no question in our minds that local governments care about their employees, are concerned about their employees' welfare. They work very hard and usually successfully to meet the needs of individual employees, either through policies, practice, or collective bargaining. Cities and counties feel very strongly that Senate Bill 518 is much too broad and does not foster the work environment of working through a problem between the employee and employer to conclusion. We urge your no vote on Senate Bill 518. I'm open for questions.
Any questions?
Thank you.
Thank you very much, Colleen. Mr. Gilliam?
Good morning. Joe Gilliam, representing National Federation of Independent Business. We're here in opposition of Senate Bill 518 for many of the same reasons you've already heard this morning from Carl Fredericks and Colleen Haas. I think one of the most dangerous things about this bill, and as widespread as it is the cost for the majority of employers in the state are small employers, as you well know, and the costs associated with having a person go on leave with full reinstatement and then putting a temporary in that place. Because we're not talking about just a short period of time. We're talking about a potential here of 9 months, obviously. But in addition to the 12 weeks of parental leave, it's also added on for some employers in this state. The Heritage Foundation, which collects data for businesses and business expenses on the East Coast, estimates that $11,200 per employee is the cost of a person on leave, bringing a temporary in, training that person, and then letting them go when the other person comes back. And it's not only the cost involved here, but I think this bill is going to foster some discrimination towards women in the workplace for small businesses. Not because the small businesses don't like women, but because they won't be able to afford the possibility of a pregnancy on the job with this bill. And you're going to see there's going to be choices between two people do the job, one of female of childbearing years, and perhaps another female that's older or younger, or a male in the situation, and they're going to opt for the person who is not going to be to have the ability to bear children. So this bill is much far-reaching other than the fact that it's a bill. It's a pro-family bill. I mean, that's easy to say, but I believe the choice is going to come down for people and there has to be some responsibility in whether it's not the choice between a healthy pregnancy or a job. It's going to be the choice of, can we afford in our situation, in our family, another child? Can I afford to leave my job? Because that is the natural flow of the workforce. We leave for many reasons in and out of the labor force. Some people go to school. Some people are transferred because their spouses are transferred in the job. Some people leave for dependent care. And a lot of people leave because they become pregnant and they can no longer perform that job. But that's going to have to be the decision of the worker beforehand. Now, we don't have any problem with the first part of the bill. If there is an available job that's less strenuous or hazardous or away from chemicals, as mentioned today, that they should be transferred. And I don't think employers are going to, they wouldn't have a problem with that. I don't think they do that now. It's the people I represent. They're not there they're concerned about the health of the child also. But this bill, the way it's written, and the requirements it puts on small business, they'll have to make other accommodations because of this policy, and I think it'll cause a discrimination of the women it's trying to protect. You have any questions?
Questions, Mr. Gilliam. Thank you. Anyone else wish to testify on Senate Bill 518? Okay, we'll close the public hearing on Senate Bill 518. Go into a work session now on House Bill 20. Let's do 3425. That's probably a little easier right now. 3425. As soon as my lawyer gets in here.
I guess. There he is. I don't think we do.
Max, we're in a work session on 3425. Do we have some amendments for this? 3425. Told the photographers from the minority office that perhaps he'd take pictures of us too.
Mr. Chairman, I'm sure for the same fee we can arrange that.
I thought it was Steve Dean's.
They pay you guys?
No, we pay.
It isn't Steve Dean's photographer?
For the congressional shoot, you know.
Fresh up. The chosen?
God, it's getting deep.
And we set.
Right. Here we go, 3425.
Max, you want to tell us what these amendments do?
Yes.
Whose they are?
You have a Hammond Gross dated May 23rd, 1989. That's and there should be two pages. I'm going to be suggesting that we change the second page, but the Hammond Gross belonged to the people involved in the system, the management people, essentially. It simply would take, and I haven't had these prepared in LC form because they're real jammed up down there, and this is fairly explanatory. What this would do is on line 20, take the subsection 4 and take it out and substitute a new subsection 4. This bill, as it would say, essentially says that the statutory hours per day does not apply to employees who are represented by a labor organization for purposes of collective bargaining with their employer, provided that the limits on required hours of work and overtime payment have been agreed to in that agreement. And if no agreement is reached, then for the purposes of this paragraph, then such limits on payment shall not be deemed to be changed from the previous collective bargaining agreement between the employer and the labor organization, unless the employees have been locked out, are engaged in a strike, or the employer has unilaterally implemented new terms and conditions of employment. If those one of those three were to happen, then the statute would kick in and then you could only work those hours.
Okay.
I will
any
tell
questions?
You.
Oh, go ahead, Max.
The other set of amendments that you have are what I'm suggesting as a replacement for the second page, and this is simply the my best effort along with Boley's best effort to get the correct civil penalty language as well as what the judiciary is now asking for as far as the lien language, so it would all be correct. I'm suggesting that if you decide to take this this amendment as proposed on the Hand and Gross, that you also take what Boley and I are suggesting as the penalty provision.
Chairman. Rep. St. Griffin.
Max, is that what we're saying is that if you have a collective bargaining agreement, you can work more than 10 hours?
That's correct.
If you don't have a collective bargaining agreement or you're not affiliated with the union, then you can't work more than 10
hours? Or not affiliated with the union. If there's no collective bargaining agreement, then the statute says how many hours you can work. Now, there are a couple exempted areas, except for logging train crews, watchmen, firemen, and persons engaged in transportation to and from work, and if there's imminent danger of loss of life or property, then you could work more than 10 hours without a collective bargaining agreement. But for purposes of this section, you're correct. If there's no collective bargaining agreement, you would have to be within the statute. But if you do have a collective bargaining agreement, you can go outside the statute as far as hours worked.
Would this include, say, someone working on a farm?
Manufacturing.
This section, the statute reads at line 17, this section does not apply to persons employed in the area of or livestock. So if you're dealing with livestock or the care of quarters, then this doesn't. The statute never did. This is an old statute, by the way. The statute never did apply to livestock, people working with livestock. And I don't know about the livestock themselves. I suppose they could. I've been over
here. Okay.
Mr. Chair.
Rep. St. Dominic.
Yeah, this is an issue I've been following pretty close, as some of you other committee members are aware. I was wanting to, all the way through the process, bring the people in the timber industry up to par with the rest of manufacturing. I have decided that I'm willing to go to the interim committee and try to resolve those issues. And that deals with the 030 section, which gives an exemption to people in sawmills, logging, and shingle mills, I believe it is. So there's still a big problem that exists with the law the way it's written. And what I'd like to do, and I've got the agreement of some of those players from the Pacific Association of Pulp and Paper Manufacturers, to sit down in the interim committee and try to resolve that issue. With that in mind, Mr. Chair, I would move the hand engrossed House Bill 3425 as amended. And I guess if I could put it in the same motion, I would take Max's amendments for the second page.
All right. Representative Dominick moves the hand engrossed House Bill 3425 with the addition of committee counsel's amendments relating to civil penalty provisions. Any discussion? Max, would this apply to, say, some paper company that would fly in out-of-state strike breakers into Oregon?
You mean as to how long they can work those strike breakers?
I think they need 5 minute recess.
I think the statute would apply there. Okay. If there's an engaged in a strike.
You can, Mr. Chairman, you can shorten that a little bit. I think there's a five-letter word that covers it even better.
Yeah, well, that's what I meant.
Okay, I just wanted to get that on the record. Y'all.
Any further discussion? Is there any objection to the amendment? So ordered.
So, Mr. Chair, I'd move...
Representative Dominick.
I'd move House Bill 3425 as amended to the floor with due pass recommendation.
Representative Dominick moves House Bill 3425 as amended to the floor with a due pass recommendation.
Let's be sure he carries it.
Any further discussion? Shannon, please call the roll.
Representative
Dirtler? Aye.
Representative
Dominey? Aye.
Representative Edmondson?
No.
Representative Johnson?
Aye.
Representative Hayden?
Aye.
Representative Manick?
Aye.
Representative Walton?
Aye.
Representative Woody?
Aye.
Chair Shiprock?
Aye.
House Bill 3425 is amended, sent to the floor with a due pass. Any volunteers?
Why I voted no.
It may die right here.
That's why you voted no. I'll volunteer, Mr. Chairman.
Representative Mannix will carry the bill.
Let's do 3423.
Okay. Do what?
Your computer goes digital. There goes the code. Grab it.
The code, it was
caught
in
the glare.
Oh.
Most hamper. Must be an important bill.
Here it is. Why don't I speak to this? You have amendments for this, Max?
Yes, I do. Should have some dash two amendments.
We'll open work session on House Bill 3423. I'll speak to this briefly. This was a bill we heard some time ago. There was a very large fiscal impact in the original printed bill. I got with the Bureau of Labor and Industries Apprenticeship Division and substantially changed this. And you have now in front of us a scaled-down version of a bill that is designed to put some certification in the apprenticeship program to quantify the skills of the apprentice that are being graduated.
Will this still require a forwarding to Ways and Means?
I don't believe so.
Oh, this is the difference.
There we go.
There's a fiscal $50,000. That's an expensive staff for $50,000 for 3 years of owners. I think part of it's part there. It's not appropriate. They're not premises to the state. What do they want to do?
AGC?
Yeah.
No, that's probably...
Max, you want to explain the dash one amendments?
The dash one amendments, I don't think are really germane here.
Well, it's hard to follow.
Right. Let's go to dash two. Should have some dash two amendments. Everybody have those? I just handed them out.
Oh, yeah. Here they are. Okay.
The dash two amendments are an attempt to scale down the bill. The bill initially talked to certification of new apprentices and certification of those people practicing currently in those fields and various other costs involved in the program. This amendment would simply say that BOLI is to establish a certification program for new apprentices and to certify those people with a certification when they come out of the program. And that's all it does. It doesn't certify current people. It just takes, it's a prospective look at what can be done.
Any questions?
And these amendments, whose are they?
Dash two of the amendments are Representative Shiprock and Boley.
Okay.
Yeah, Quint's here if you wanted to speak to him.
Someone want to move these amendments?
I'll move the amendments.
Representative Johnson moves the dash two amendments. Discussion on those. We'll adopt these and we'll go to the other ones. Is there any discussion on the dash two amendments? Is there any objection to them? Hearing none, so ordered. You also have in front of you some proposed amendments from the Associated General Contractors. And did somebody wish to discuss, Representative Johnson?
Well, they're here. I guess I'd like to have someone tell the committee what they do and why they want that.
Mr. Nelson?
If it's appropriate to the bill or not.
Mr. Chairman, members of the committee, my name is Jack Nelson, and I represent the Associated General Contractors. You should have before you a copy of the amendments that I submitted to the committee with a letter, and I included material from one of the programs that is currently being developed by the Associated General Contractors nationally for residential and commercial carpenters and brick masons. What we're suggesting in the amendments, and I think that the bill as well as the dash two amendments are unclear in establishing the Apprenticeship Council in developing the certification program. It doesn't appear to us that there is a vehicle for other programs to be submitted for review, either to be approved or disapproved by the council. And the amendments that we have submitted and submitted on the 28th of April, we think creates that that process or procedure. I'm not here to discuss the merits of AGC's program or other programs. They do exist, and I think that would be a benefit to the state to have the ability to for other programs to be submitted for analysis and review.
Jack, why would the Apprenticeship Council want to consider certification programs that are contrary to the apprenticeship laws? I'm familiar with your program, but all you do basically is have people take a simple test, and then they can call themselves a journeyman. It's nothing at all like apprenticeship, and I think it's a lot different.
Maybe if the Republicans would go outside the spending limit, we could get this.
You'll move this as a separate issue on the floor outside.
We're not in work session.
I'm going to suggest that the proponents of House Bill 2921 go back to the drawing board. There's no sense sending this to Ways and Means at this point, and this with this type of a fiscal impact, it will never see the light of day.
Well, Mr. Chair, in view of that, I'll withdraw my motion.
I would hope so.
Thank you, Representative Minson.
Mr. Chairman.
Representative Mannix.
There might be some technical changes we can make in the system to make it work better, and I'd be willing to do that, but big fiscal impact stuff is another story. And I'm willing to cooperate in that, but yeah. I have some problems with the big changes here.
Well, it's...
I guess
I've said enough. We'll work on it. And we'll get the proponents back together, and but they're going to have to lower the fiscal impact statement down a little bit. Okay, we'll close the hearing on House Bill 2921. Go to House 1051, Lucky.
We're in pretty good shape.
Is that in good shape?
I think we're okay on that one.
Okay. Work session, Senate Bill 1051. Representative Mannix, I believe you and Representative Durfler, if I'm not mistaken, worked on this bill?
Yes, Mr. Chairman.
Tell us what you got?
I met with Representative Durfler, and then I had a chance to meet with Senator Hill and Mr. Fiscom from the Executive Department. The work group came up with the -A5 amendments as agreed language.
The dash what?
A5. Oh, yeah.
Here they come. I got two.
And I have conferred with Senator Hill, and he confirmed that the -A5 amendments were satisfactory. I understand Mr. Fiscom had also conferred with Senator Hill about one phrase that needed to be changed based on a comment from Legislative Council Council to the Governor. May we invite Mr. Fiscom up to mention Dave? That? I think it's at page 3 of the A5 at the bottom.
Mr. Chairman, for the record, Dave Fiscom, the Executive Department. We do support the compromise that appears before you in the A5 amendments with one suggestion for a change that relates to line 30 on page 3. And the suggestion we have would be to remove the words toward the end of that sentence that are, quote, described in ORS 192.502 sub 1, and to add in their place the actual language from the statute.
Could you read that, please?
The language to be added after the word information is as follows, quote, of an advisory nature to the extent that it is other than purely factual and is preliminary to any final determination of policy or action, end quote.
line 30.
Say that again. Of an advisory nature to the extent that...
Of an advisory nature to the extent that it is other than purely factual and is preliminary to any final determination of policy or action. That is a quote from that statute cited, as opposed to citing by number the statute 192.502.
Could you do that just one more time?
Be happy to. Of an advisory nature, to the extent that it is other than purely factual and is preliminary to any final determination of policy or action.
Thank you. Did you have a chance to check with Senator Hill about that phrase?
Mr. Chairman, Representative Mannix, I did, and he concurs that that change, concurs that he supports that change. He did make one other comment, and he's in the room. He may want to do this on his own, but up in lines 28, he suggested that the actual citation more accurately should be 192.501 to 192.505. And that is fine with us. That is the actual narrowing down of the statute to the list of exemptions to the public records law as cited in the statute. But in summary, he concurred with the changes I've suggested to you.
Mr. Chairman?
Representative Manning?
Mr. Fiscom, you might want to amend this, but wouldn't it be fair for me to represent to the committee that what we did was we sat down and we dealt with the original bill as passed by the Senate, and what we basically addressed were the policy concerns that the executive branch had raised in regard to the provision of information as to in-house consultations within the executive branch and accessibility by others, including the legislature, to that?
Mr. Chairman, that's accurate. I should say that we appreciate your work and Representative Durfler's work to resolve the differences, and again, the spirit with which Senator Hill proceeded with us to develop this compromise. Our concern focused on Section 3 of the original bill, which is in fact contained in the current A5 amendments before you. It deals with relationship between the executive and legislative branches. This change resolves that concern that we had and enunciated to you. The other concerns that we raised were, by definition at that time, secondary, and in fact, as a product of the meeting we had in your office, those were resolved without change in the current bill. Just to be specific there was an issue we raised with regard to the insertion of the Bureau of Labor and Industries in terms of its responsibility. We understand why that's been done and have no difficulty with that being included. So the central concern we had with relationship to the executive branch, legislative branch issues were resolved in those discussions.
Mr. Chairman?
Yes, Representative.
There's this basic working group agreement in which I intend to move in a moment. Then I understand Senator Hamby has a proposal, and there is also a separate working group informational proposal, because which I'll talk about separately, this A4. The reason I've separated it out was that wasn't something I felt I could deal with within the working group, because we hadn't dealt with the issue and discussions in the committee, and the committee had previously dealt with this similar issue and had taken a broader route. Should I explain that now, or the A4?
We want to stay on this because I want to, just for a second, because our council's asked a question that I'd like to answer or ask myself, and that's, Dave, why do you wish to recite the statute in line 30 instead of simply referencing it? Is there some...
Sure.
Just tell us why you want to do
that. Mr. Chairman, I'm happy you asked that question. I meant to make that point and then forgot after I read the statute. The concern relates, and it's not, concern is the wrong word, the issue relates to the fact that the sentence as drafted on lines 29 and 30 uses the word information and then goes on to list the statute, the actual citation of the statute pertains only to written records, documents that are pieces of paper that have writing on them,
as opposed to the intent of the language previous to that relating to information. And it was felt that by citing the words from the statute and leaving information there, you didn't have what was described to me by our counsel as a non sequitur. Information and then only the actual citation pertaining to pieces of paper with writing on them. The spirit of the compromise that was negotiated, as I understood it, was more broadly than just a piece of paper that had words on them, which is the intent of the public records law.
Yeah, I'm just talking form and style here. Yes, I'm not trying to make a policy.
There's a little more there in the sense that if you just read the statute, it's only written information. Now the way they've described it, it's also oral information. So they are a little broader than the statute by doing it this way.
Okay. Thank you.
Good point.
We did clarify that. Good
point.
Okay.
Mr. Chairman.
On the Dash 5 amendments, Representative Mannix.
I move the Dash 5 amendments to the bill.
Representative Mannix moves the Dash 5 amendments.
With the corrections as noted.
May I check to see if I am right? Did you intend to change in line 28 the ORS reference? It would then read 192 period 501.
Yes.
To 192.505.
Yes.
And then on line 30, it would take out, after the word formation, it would take out the rest of the sentence and insert of an advisory nature to the extent that they cover other than purely factual materials and are preliminary to any final agency determination of policy or action.
I think, was it that it is other than purely factual? Is that
Mr. Chairman, I think your counsel is probably accurate. Senator Hill and I did this out in the hall without a good table to write on, and the words they cover is probably the accurate rendition.
Fine.
I think the statute's been read.
Okay.
Thank you.
Any further discussion on the amendment as amended?
Mr. Chairman.
For Representative
Page
Walden.
5, line 2.
Okay.
Where do we set up the $500 minimum?
May I address
awards?
That?
Awards.
Representative Mannix, yeah.
We tried to allow for a limitation so that, and in a way, there's a sanction there too. Actual damages are likely to usually be very small. And this is, in effect, a sanction, but it's a $500 limit. In other words, there are some things that are hard to determine in terms of what's the valuation of some damages. And this will allow the judge to go as high as $500, saying, look, we'll give you up to $500. If damages turned out to be greater than that, then they couldn't get more than the $500. Excuse me, they could get more than the $500.
Mm-hmm, right.
But if they were indeterminate, kind of ethereal damages about, well, I've lost my opportunities within the agency and so forth, the judge could say, I'll compensate you up to $500. That's my understanding. Mr. Fiskin might want to supplement that.
That's what it is.
And counsel concurs.
I would ask.
Representative Johnson?
Do you believe, Representative Mannix, do you believe it's good public policy to have a penalty like that for public sector employers?
If they violated this Whistleblower Act, yes. I mean, the Whistleblower Act is designed to protect employees who are going to be bringing out information about inappropriate action by an agency or violation of statutes by an agency. And if someone then tries to sanction the employee in violation of this act and the employee is harmed, they can seek relief under this provision. And in seeking relief, they can get actual damages, but in effect, there's a $500 for an agency. I generally call that a slap on the wrist for having violated this act, where there isn't some precise calculation of damages. And it's meant to add some teeth to the provision.
Any further discussion on the amendment?
Mr. Chairman.
Representative Walden.
The next page has a similar provision that limits it to $200. Line 10, page 6. A separate section, I realize. Why do we do 200 there and 500?
There's a reason I'm trying to remember.
Mac?
I'm not sure why there's a difference in, because I didn't put this together, I'm not sure why there's a difference in those two. I can tell you the difference is one is a civil penalty and a civil action by what a judge can do, and the other one is an administrative thing that Boley could do as a penalty for violating. This makes it an unemployment, an unlawful employment practice, and gives them the ability to do comp damages or $200, whichever is greater. And I can't tell you, I don't know why there's a difference in the money.
The only answer I can give you is I left it at 200 because it was that way in the original bill. We didn't have the other figure dealt with at all, and I thought there should be a limit. So we put the 500 in, and I'd be amenable to changing the 500 if you thought it'd be consistent. And I think that's a good idea, actually.
You want to move that?
I would agree to change the $200 to $500.
Oh, I was going to go the other way.
Is it an either-or case? Or both penalties could be imposed?
Both penalties could be imposed because it's unlawful employment practice in one and civil relief in another.
That's right. Correct. Mm-hmm.
We could split the difference and make it 250 on both.
I would support that. If you want to move that.
I'd be willing to make it 250 on both.
Okay, Mannix amends his amendment to...
Man, I better read this.
It'd be
on page 5, line 2, to change 500 to 250. And on page 6, line 10, to change 200 to 250. Okay, any further discussion of the amendment? Is there objection to the amendment? Hearing none, so ordered.
Mr. Chairman?
Representative Mannix.
We previously had a somewhat different whistleblower bill in regard to the employment division and reporting on warrants that are outstanding. And we had a long discussion in this committee about what kind of warrants ought to be the kind of thing that you pursued. And we finally said any person charged with a crime, which would be felonies and misdemeanors. The bill that came to us limited employees to being able to report on warrants for felonies. And since this committee had previously taken a broader view, I raised that in the work group, and Senator Hill felt fairly strongly that it should be limited to felonies from his own perspective. My own perspective was somewhat different, and I felt it wasn't appropriate to just come in here with a loaded deck, so I suggested that we just have a separate proposed amendment that allows this committee to address the philosophical question as to whether or not you felt that an employee should be able to pursue misdemeanor warrants as well, which is still a warrant for a crime, not violation or offense type warrants, if there are such things actually, but other groups of crimes labeled misdemeanors. And I have to say that my personal view is that we ought to, but I didn't feel it was appropriate for me to limit the discussion, and I thought I should come back with that option for the committee to decide.
Okay. Instead of moving, why don't we just talk about it? Then you've got the dash four amendments. Any discussion on the amendment? Any thoughts of the committee?
Could you describe some misdemeanor crimes?
All, lesser assault cases, criminal mischief. Trespass. Theft, lesser types of damage to property, willful damage to property.
Where is that at?
It's just kind of off the top of my head. We've been decriminalizing some other things while we've been adding to other criminal sanctions, but there's still a lot of misdemeanors out there.
Mr. Chair, Representative Domini.
Just for my own clarification, if a department agency were to misappropriate money, would that be a misdemeanor, or what class of a crime would that be considered, or is it even a crime?
He wasn't asking me, was he?
I was asking whoever might have the answer. Maybe Representative Mannix has the answer. If a department were to misappropriate money and another individual were to discover the misappropriation of money, is that a misdemeanor or
deliberate misappropriation?
That's not.
Or negligent.
I think if it's intentional, you're talking about a crime, violating statutory limitations. If it's negligent, probably not.
Would it be a misdemeanor?
Yeah, it'd start out as a misdemeanor depending on the amount. The higher the amount, you shift into felonies.
Yeah. Any other thoughts of the rest of the committee on this idea?
Mr. Chairman,
Representative Walden.
I'd like the idea personally of expanding it.
To misdemeanor?
I think so. If we've got some folks out there that are violating the law, we have an opportunity to identify them. We certainly pay our police forces to go out and look for them. I think we should be able to enlist the aid of government, other sectors.
Okay.
Mr. Chairman.
Representative Manning.
A lot of the fraud and deception offenses start out as misdemeanors and then work up into felonies depending on the amount. But just throwing out some examples in response to Representative Johnson's question, I'm just trying to flip through the criminal code right now.
I move the four amendments.
Representative Johnson moves the dash four amendments. Further discussion? Is there objection to those amendments? Hearing none, so ordered.
Mr. Chair,
yes.
There are one other set of amendments that were delivered to us late last night from Senator Hamby's office regarding a section in the bill. I think now it would probably be a better idea to look on your A5 amendments, and I'll show you where this would take place. Line 3, page 5. Page 5, line 3. Identified as Section 8, it talks about the identity of the employee who discloses any of the following shall not be disclosed without the written consent of the employee during any investigation of the information or any related matters. This amendment that you have in front of you with Senator Hamby's name on it dated May 31st would propose to delete in this amendment lines 3 through 8.
Section 8.
It would take out the whole section.
Why?
We have somebody from Senator Hamby's office here if you would like to ask her why.
Representative Woody?
Yes, I would like to ask why.
Good morning.
Good morning. Mary Grimes, 2563 Honeysuckle Way, Salem, for the record, legislative assistant for Senator Hamby. Senator Hamby voted for this bill as it passed the Senate and was one of the co-sponsors on it. However, since then and just recently, the city of Hillsboro has written us a city manager and feels that that particular section, the way it's written, does not serve the best purposes, not only of city government, but other public agencies, feeling that there is a right for the accused to be faced by the accuser, and that this is going to result in court actions rather than things that could be solved through grievances. Another thing, too, when you get in, if you really take the bill apart, subs 1 and 2 under that really don't make an awful lot of sense legally or statutorily the way the bill is written, but that's aside a mechanical issue. Senator Hamby has asked me to come today, though, and ask for this deletion. It's my understanding, though, that you worked very hard on the amendments you recently just immediately proposed. She feels that there should be a balance considering what her constituents feel is very important to the rights not only of the employee but the employer. The wording as far as any stage of the investigation denies that employee the right. And in light of some recent things that have gone on in the state of Oregon in one of our agencies, we can appreciate your concerns, but how far can you go a piece of legislation like this to deny the rights of the employer, supervisor, whoever is affected? And that's her position on this.
Question.
I do. Representative Hayden.
Yeah. Mary, I could ask you, or I think your argument's a good one. I don't know whether to ask you or committee counsel or one of the attorneys on the committee, but if the matter would go to court, would the person who is being investigated then have the right to challenge the person who makes the accusations in court?
the way this reads right now, and I'm sure that Max knows more about this area of the law than I do, but the way this reads right now, that once it actually goes into the court proceeding, yes, any stage of the investigation prior to that, it won't. And that was one of the concerns about the city of Hillsborough, is that there are things that they could probably solve internally or on a grievance level or with their union people, rather than every time something like this happens, have to go to court to resolve it.
Mr. Chairman?
Representative.
This was something that we brought up in the meeting with Senator Hill and Mr. Fiscombe, and I had not addressed it yet earlier with Representative Durfler, but I asked why we had this section in, and Senator Hill pointed out that it was important to focus on the word during any investigation of the information, that this protects the employee who wants to make a confidential report about something the employee suspects but maybe can't verify, allows people to investigate what the employee has suspected but can't verify. They may find out that there's no basis for the report and the matter is over. It's to encourage an employee to be willing to come forward confidentially. On the other hand, once someone's done an investigation, if they intend to take any action, that protection ceases. And from that point forward, the protection is gone and you have a right to face your accuser. There is no accuser, in effect, unless the investigation has confirmed that there's something worth proceeding on. And the balance that Senator Hill described, and I thought it was a fair balance, was that we want to encourage people to come forward. They might not have verified information. They may have suspicions. And if by coming forward with suspicions to present to someone, it turns out they're going to be immediately identified, they may be shy about that. On the other hand, the balance is, again, the right to face your accuser. When the investigation is over, if anything's about to happen, then you have a right to know who it was, and you can confront that person, you can deal with the issues at that point. But if no action is taken, no harm is done, and the person making the report remains...
Mr. Chair, Representative Mannix, I agree with you in essence, but if you look at sub A and B under section 7, sub 1, paragraph A and B, and you go back in particularly to B, that deals with the warrants that you were talking about earlier, and I can't see that line of reasoning applies to that situation, because you're dealing with someone who's a beneficiary of the process rather than someone internally in the process.
May I respond to that?
Go ahead.
The reason for that is a fear of repercussions. If that felon or misdemeanant finds out that I reported to the police agency that there's a warrant out on them, I might find that more than rocks are thrown through my windows at night. I may find someone breaking in my back door. I want to remain unknown until that person's been apprehended by the police authorities. Again, after they've done their investigation and apprehended that person, then that person gets to know who reported them, and there's a balance again there. And that's the fear of retribution.
Mr. Chair, Representative Mannix, I can agree with you, and I'm sure Senator Hamby would. However, there is, dealing with government, looking at it in relationship to private enterprise and accountability of the employees in their relationship to that agency. And for them to walk around, we see them terrorized in fear. I think there's a little bit of a problem in our agencies to begin with. That does not compute as far as making sense. And then if you go back in the same note, you go back in and you take that paragraph A, where it says matters described in there, I'd like someone to explain that to me, because it doesn't even make sense. So what you end up with section 7, which would be your section 8, is the identity of the employee, blah, 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 and any related matters with a colon, and there's nothing underneath it that has any relevance to reality.
There's a grammatical problem there, which I just picked up on. I agree with you on the grammatical. We'll deal with that separately. But on the philosophical issue, Mr. Chairman, I agree with Senator Hill's final position. So.
Mr. Chairman.
Thank you, Mary. Representative Woody?
If we allow this amendment, you might as well just junk the bill, because it doesn't give any incentive to anybody. I mean, as soon as they turn somebody in, they're going to be in the, or as an investigation in the process, then everybody in the whole building or whatever, or the world, is going to know who they are, so they're not going to turn anybody in. I mean, and after all, this is a whistleblower law, and we're trying to set up some criteria whereby employees will know under what conditions, if they turn somebody in, that they're going to be treated, and that just kills it. I don't even think it the bill. I'd like to know what the relevancy of the bill is after we put this amendment in, if we ever do.
Okay, thank you.
Thank you.
Representative Mannix?
I do have a motion.
Go ahead.
For page 5 of the now in front of us A5 amendments, line 5, this is a grammatical correction, where it says, during any investigation of the information, delete or in any related matters, colon, and insert provided relating to, colon. So it would read, during any investigation of the information provided relating to. That meant provided by the employee. Maybe we should say provided by the employee relating to. That would be even clearer.
We'll take that as a friendly amendment.
Thank you.
We have this anyway. It's still on the amendment. We've adopted the dash of 5
amendments, and we just
that's
amended
a technical yeah. change there that Max can pick up.
Mr. Chairman,
Representative Mannix.
I move the bill as amended to the floor with a G-pass recommendation.
Representative Mannix moves Senate Bill 1051 as amended. Before we do pass recommendation.
And that's with dash 4 and dash 5 as amended.
That's correct. Any discussion? Shannon, call the roll.
Representative Edmondson?
Aye.
Representative Johnson?
Who on by?
Representative
Hayden?
Aye. Representative Mannix?
Aye.
Representative Walton? Representative Witte?
Aye. Representative Walton's here.
Representative Walton?
Aye.
Representative Durkler?
Aye.
Representative Dahme?
Aye.
Representative Johnson?
I'll vote aye. Reluctant aye.
Well, let me think.
I don't know what the hell we did.
Want to file minority report?
Which bill?
I'll vote aye. Senate Bill 1051 is amended. Sent to the floor will be passed. Who wants to carry this? Representative Mannix? Okay.
Give me a heart attack.
Good memory.
It's what? Time to close the committee, I'm sure.
You want to sign a resolution?
Okay, moving right along.
2981.
We had some brief testimony. Pardon me. We've had quite a bit of testimony on the bill and an explanation of the bill last session from Representative Mannix. We ran out of time.